comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. I know you could be doing a million other things tonight, but you chose to be here, and I appreciate that. I'm here because you have a right to know. I'm here because you matter. We have a special event coming up in our members community, and tonight, after the show, I will be going into the announcements forum and posting the date and times for this special event. Every once in a while, I throw out a special event, or I throw in a special event. I put it into the mix, and in the members community. This will be a seminar. I'll be leading a seminar called Mars, the Fading Fog, and that's going to be coming up one Saturday this month. So the date, and there's only three left, right? So the date and time of that seminar will be posted in the announcements forum after the show tonight. Be sure, if you are a member, that you get in there and check the announcements forum. Now, for all who are members who have not yet read the new members info, even though there's a paragraph right there when you log in and it says read the new members info and the link is on the left and the people don't do it, well, you're going to not be able to figure out how to make all of this work and you're going to miss it. So I really recommend that you read the road signs and don't drive with your eyes closed. Read the new members info and then go over to the announcements forum and you'll be able to get the information about this seminar that's coming up. I don't think you want to miss it. It is a free gift if you are a member. If you're not a member, well, hey, fix it. All you have to do is just click where it says join and just go through the little procedure there and join and then you'll be a member. And then you'll get in on all this good stuff, all right, including our archives. You get to watch the show. You get your own blog page. You get your own video album, your own photo album. You get the forums. You get the chat room. You get all the special broadcasts we do and lots more. And there's no genius in not doing it. It's only $7.50 a month. That's 25 cents a day if you work it out, you know, how much per day. 25 cents a day. That's less than you paid for your school lunch when you were in the second grade. I don't think you can find a better deal anywhere. So we'd love to see you in the members community. Come on in. We also have something that you need to avail yourself of. If you haven't, it's called the K-Files. The K-Files is our free weekly newsletter, and we would love to have you as part of our subscriber family. There's no genius in not getting the K-Files either. It's free, and you can unsubscribe anytime you want to, so where's the genius in not getting it? Go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and click where it says K-Files, and subscribe. Then you will no longer be in the land of the mushrooms, where everything is dark, and all the news is manure. You'll be in the light. We're going to step away for a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Christopher O'Brien. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And let me remind you, before we bring our guest on, let me remind you that the Kevin Smith Show is always free to listen. Free to listen from anywhere in the world. And we're delighted to have you with us. But we are listener supported. And so consider stepping up to the plate and helping us continue to broadcast. It gets really tight around here, and we need you. If you think that what we're doing is valuable, if you like this show and you like the information that we bring to you, and by the way, if you like the scoops, you know, sometimes we scoop major media as much as a year in advance. Really, I'm not joking. We've done that. But it's not uncommon for us to scoop major media 2-3 months in advance. And if you think that is important and you want to know and you want to be a part of the leading edge of the information, well, we have to be able to be here tomorrow, don't we? And so we need you. We need you to join the members community, and we need you to donate to the cause. But you get something for that, too. When you get into the members community, it's a different universe, believe me. All right, my guest this evening is Christopher O'Brien. Now, those of you who attended the Alternative Universe Eye Conference on this past Saturday, you already have met Christopher O'Brien. He spoke in the conference. He was one of the presenters. Some of you, you've already met him at other conferences, and you've heard him on radio shows, and you've read his books, and some of you, well, you're new to the genre, and you don't know him yet. Christopher O'Brien is an author. He's a researcher. He's a journalist. Three of his books are Secrets of the Mysterious Valley, Enter the Valley, and Stalking the Tricksters. And Stalking the Tricksters has a long title. It goes like this: Stalking the Tricksters, Shapeshifters, Skinwalkers, Dark Adepts, and 2012. He's also an award-winning filmmaker, and he is also a musician. Christopher, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Hey, Kevin, it's been a while. Good to be back.
Well, and it's good to have you back with us. You sort of were with us. You were with us for the conference, but that's not the same thing as being on the Kevin Smith Show. And
nope.
But that
it's been
was fairly
since November 2009. I think.
It's been a while. Why is that?
Hey, we're both busy guys. We both have radio shows, and we're both out there beating the pavement for, you know, these breaking stories that we're all so enamored by. And, you know, I've got many hats on.
Well, yeah, as do I, and as do many of us in this genre. You know, in this genre, you can't just specialize in one thing. You have to wear a lot of different hats because it's I guess you could specialize in just one thing. But, I mean, it's such a broad territory. The information is so... there's so much information that's sort of related to each other that, you know, you have to wear a lot of different hats.
That's true.
Let's talk about the filmmaker hat. One of your films has just won some awards. Tell us about that.
Well, we've, along with my co-producers, Ron James and Jennifer Stein, the two of them, about 3 years ago, started working on a project which has now, I guess, been given the name, the Disclosure Dialogues. And essentially what they did was they went to the X conference, Stephen Bassett's conference, and on the disclosure movement, exopolitics. And they interviewed experts, ufological experts, in dialogue with each other. And over a three-year period, they amassed quite an impressive list of luminaries in the field discussing the whole subject of disclosure with each other. And there's about 10 to 12 hours of dialogues that are in this particular DVD set. And about a year and a half ago, they kicked around the idea of releasing it just in dialogue form, and I suggested that, hey, why not distill all these wonderful dialogues down into a standalone hour feature film that sort of encompasses the entire, you know, four DVDs and gives a listener a real cut to the chase, sort of our boiled down version of the project. So it was four trips back and forth to LA, lots of production problems, broken drives. Just it was a really difficult project to put to bed, but we did deliver a standalone documentary called It Could Happen Tomorrow to the International UFO Congress this year, and 2 weeks ago we won the best feature film, and then we also won the People's Choice Award, which was quite gratifying. It was a labor of love. Quite a bit of time, effort, and energy went into the project, and I guess in the end it all sort of came together for us, and we were grateful to be selected as the best film this year.
Well, congratulations. Thank you. I would assume that this is a DVD that is for sale. It's available. People can purchase mm-hmm. this. How can they get it?
Well, we have they can go to my website, OurStrangePlanet.com, also the ParanormalMediaGroup.com, and at the Paracast, where I'm co-host with Gene Steinberg. There's links on the pages to get it. We do have an introductory offer of $29.95 or $30 for a five DVD set, which is a pretty reasonable price. And without question, it is by far the most comprehensive look at the whole subject of disclosure, all the implications, whether they be political, social, religious, scientific, philosophic. All these issues that surround this very hot-button topic are addressed in depth by ufologists having conversations with each other. They're not talking directly at the camera. For the most part, they're talking to each other, and it makes for some really spirited repartee and just editing the piece, knowing quite a bit about the field and the whole subject. I was amazed at how much I learned from listening to folks a lot more knowledgeable about aspects of the disclosure question than I am, and I came away with a pretty good working knowledge of why this probably will never happen. I find it kind of ironic. I was one of three dissenting voices in the entire project that don't think that the government's ever going to disclose anything to us. My contention has been for years that even if they did disclose something to us, how could we believe them? They've been lying for 60 plus years. So I really was kind of forced to put my objective journalist hat on and really kind of keep my own opinion sort of in check while I put together the most objective piece as I could possibly put together. So
well, let me tell you something that I did. I cannot remember now when it was, but Two, maybe 3 years ago, I did a show where I asked people, we talked about disclosure, and I asked people, I started out asking, what would it take for you to say that's disclosure? How out front and up front would it have to be? But the question quickly changed because of the calls that were coming in, and calls came in for the full 2 hours from all over the place, and we had flash messages from around the world. But the question quickly changed from what would it take for you to say, okay, that's disclosure. It changed to, would you believe disclosure? I mean, within
exactly.
The first two or three calls, that's what they said. They said, I don't know what it would take because I wouldn't believe them. And I got to tell you something. All those calls, every single one of them, 100% that night, 100% said they would not believe any statement the government has to make about disclosure.
Well, you count me in that 100%.
Well, okay. And that's a shame because, you know, I had said before we did this show, I had said on a number of occasions, and I've said it since then, that the government's actions with regard to the UFO phenomenon and the way they have lied and ridiculed and destroyed people's lives is now, they've been caught lying so many times and they've been caught doing dirty deeds so many times over this subject, it's now, I said, approaching the point where the government is just irrelevant on this issue. And, you know, and I said, you know, if you guys don't want the government to be irrelevant here on this issue, you need to straighten your act up. And you need to do it real fast. But I really think it's reached a point of no return. I don't think there's any repair now that the government can do to make themselves relevant on this issue. What do you think?
I agree with that, Kevin. The way they've handled the Roswell incident, I think, really speaks volumes. You know, Roswell case closed and the final report and all these things. You know, through the tireless efforts of Congressman Stephen Schiff and others within the ufological community, getting the General Accounting Office to finally come clean and do a report. And what do? Instead of mogul balloons as the answer for the supposed Roswell crash, they added in the parachuting crash test dummies that weren't actually used for another 5 years, I think, after Roswell. They weren't introduced into use until the early 50s. So, I mean, just the way they bungled that whole scenario, I think, is indicative of the amount of control that they are, you know, maintaining over this issue. And my personal feelings are that all these countries that have slowly been coming forward, Chile is our most recent, of course, Brazil, France, Belgium, in a lesser way, the United Kingdom. I think these countries are being asked to at least produce some documents to keep the focus on these new disclosure processes going on around the world. And I think that's to keep the heat off the U.S. and the military-industrial complex in this country that it probably holds the lion's share of this type of information, and it will never come out. Government to control people and information, and the UFO subject is no different.
Well, it will never come out on purpose. However, the tighter they squeeze in order to keep the secrets, the tighter they squeeze those secrets, the more certain it is they will leak out. It's just like a tube of toothpaste. You can squeeze it, and you can squeeze it very tight for a while, but the tighter you squeeze it, at some point you're going to reach the breaking point, and that tube bursts and toothpaste comes squirting out through your fingers. And that's what's going to happen. They are squeezing
good analogy.
Tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter, and these people are fools, because what they are trying to hide is going to come squirting out through their fingers.
Well, I've always said that the government obviously knows quite a bit more than the general public knows. That's why they're that much more confused than we are. I don't think they have a clue of what they're dealing with. And rather than admit that and fess up and say, we don't have a clue, we've determined that, you know, whatever this is flying around, piloting these objects, don't appear on the surface to be a national security threat. They could never really come forward and admit that they're not in control of the situation. The government's job is to be in control of the situation, and I think it's so heavily compartmentalized and so it's so secretive in terms of the level of classification that, you know, it's almost impossible to really get a full grasp of how much the government and the private sector really does know, because the right hand doesn't know how much the left hand knows. And so I think that very fact alone is going to make it virtually impossible for an official government making an announcement type disclosure to occur. But you know, the ETs or whatever they are, extra dimensionals, the jury's still out on what we're actually dealing with. That's a whole separate topic of conversation. But whomever or whatever is flying these craft around obviously don't want their identities and presence fully known. So barring some accidental crash or you know, I think more legitimately, I think that there's a possibility of a whistleblower doing a deathbed confession that might gain some traction. But this is just going to be continue to be a merry-go-round. We're going to be going round and around, and Stephen Bassett will keep filing his initiatives, and Stephen Grill will still be out there, you know, preaching to the faithful about the subject, and we're going to see the same thing just keep getting further and further down the road with no real end in sight.
On the other hand, I am of the opinion that, you know, I don't need the government to pat me on the head and tell me, yes, you did see a doorknob. you know, I think people are competent. When you see what you see, you may not know exactly what it is, but you know everything it's not. And so when you see a UFO and your camera captures it, that's not a hallucination. Cameras do not film hallucinations. It's actually an object, and it is something that defies everything else that you know of that flies. Therefore, that is a UFO. All right, so I don't need the government then to pat me on the head and say, yes, Kevin, you did see a UFO. That makes as much sense to me as having them pat me on the head and say I saw a doorknob.
Right. And I be think careful, they might have toothpaste on their hand when
that's
they
right.
do that too.
Well, I think people are competent, and you know, they, regardless of their educational level, they're competent observers. They've had eyes all their life. Right. Okay? And they use them every day, and they've never yet mistaken Walmart for a beach ball. All right, we have to step away here for a break. And as we do, you mull that over in your mind just a bit. The debunkers always want you to think your eyes were wrong and your mind was not working right. They always want you to think you were not competent. And yet you drive a car. You walk down the street. You make it around the world wherever you want to go. You're competent enough for that. And yet, you're not competent to look up in the sky and see something you've never seen before? Nonsense. We'll be back right after this.
The Kevin Smith Show, and my IQ jumped 20 points.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Christopher O'Brien. Christopher, as we went to break, I was ranting a little bit about the fact that I think people are competent witnesses. And by the way, that's based on years as a cop and taking witness statements from people. Yeah, they get a few facts wrong here and there, but overall they tell you what they saw, and it turns out that they were right. They saw what they said they saw. And, you know, I was kind of ranting on that a little bit, but let me prove to you a point here. Why the government is completely irrelevant when it comes to disclosure and the question of are UFOs, do they really exist? Now, to my counterparts over in major media, you guys stop what you're doing, turn your little mushroom ears this direction, and pay attention, okay? Let me ask you a question, Christopher. Do you believe in beer cans, or have you seen them?
I've seen more than a few, actually, Kevin.
Okay. Do you believe in doorknobs, or have you seen them?
I've been pretty twisted in the doorknob department quite a number of times as well.
All right. You ever seen a cow?
I've seen them live, dead, and in between.
You ever seen a Cadillac?
Ridden in one quite a number of times.
Have you ever had anybody successfully convince you that a cow is a Cadillac?
I don't even think I've ever had anybody try, unless they were on like some sort of weird mushroom or something.
Yeah, well, they see, the government does that daily when they start talking about UFOs. They try to convince people that a cow is a Cadillac. They try to convince people that what they saw in the sky was a Chinese wedding lamp, or it was swamp gas, or it was a Mogul balloon, and people know what they saw. I don't believe in UFOs. There's nothing to believe. I don't believe in doorknobs. I've seen them. I've seen UFOs. There's nothing to believe. They either exist or they don't, and the government's opinion on it is completely irrelevant.
Agree more. I think as we progress further down the road, I think we're going to see more and more openness around the subject. I think in the 20 years that I've been a field investigator and researcher, I've seen a shift in the media somewhat. I think this subject is becoming less fringe as time marches on, and as soon as it gets to the point where I think it's accepted by mainstream media with the amount of gravitas that it truly deserves, I think, you know, once we get to that point, then I think there's a better chance of openness really beginning to occur within government and in the private sector. And, you know, Ben Rich, who, as some of you may know, is one of our top aerospace engineers, made some comment prior to his death about that the state and level of our technology is beyond what the average person could even imagine. So there is a possibility that some of what we're seeing flying around, of course not all, but some of what we're seeing flying around is quite terrestrial in nature. There is a school of thought that would suggest that some of our exotic and you know, secret technology is being sort of hidden within the UFO phenomenon to keep it classified and keep it secret and keep it.
Well, that was the plan, of course, back at the very beginning, both under Truman and under Eisenhower. That plan was put forth to use this very real phenomena as a cover for development of black project aircraft, and they've done it, and they're doing it, and I don't actually disagree with that. I think that's smart. Use something that's real that people are seeing as a cover for developing your black project aircraft. I think that's pretty
makes
smart.
Sense to me. It definitely has you know, it's I think quite an effective smokescreen that's
yeah.
been used, and of course the SR-71 Blackbird. I think flying, you know, well above commercial airline pilots, let's say, were reported as UFOs during the late 50s, early 60s. If you had been driving along on some remote highway in the deserts of Nevada in the late 70s, early 80s, and a stealth fighter flew over you and you had your radio on, you couldn't hear it, I mean, that would have been a UFO. The thing still looks, even though they're decommissioning them, they still look like something otherworldly. So, yeah, there's no question that this is an effective use of disinformation and utilization of the UFO phenomenon as a smokescreen for more terrestrial projects that are, you know, 15, 20 years ahead of public disclosure. So, I mean, that's why my San Luis Valley camera project in the San Luis Valley, excuse me, where I have been investigating since the late 80s, early 90s. We're putting together a three triangulated arrays, six cameras with a base station camera in one of the hottest UFO spots in North America, and we're gonna get some you know, unequivocal scientific data that we'll be able to actually publish a scientific paper. Possibly in an optics journal or a diagnostic propulsion paper, looking at the real nuts and bolts of the phenomenon. If we're able to use a gravitometer, a magnetometer, get three cameras, up to seven cameras, arrayed on a single event, it's going to be very difficult for anyone to refute that data, especially with the the Blue Ribbon team of consultants and scientists that we have helping us in this project. I'm very excited about this. We're going to have a live camera feed up and running here within a week or two, and this is how I think ufology should be moving forward. Anecdotal reports and rehashing Roswell for the umpteenth time is not going to get us further down the road. We're not going to move the ball down the field unless we come up with a way to gain hard scientific data, and that's the San Luis Valley Project is a boilerplate, basically. If we can do it there, then we're going to be able to assist other researchers and investigators around the world to put their own triangulated camera arrays up. And I think data will finally overwhelm the mystery. I mean, we're in the day and age now where the level of technology and the quality of technology, coupled with the internet and the low cost of the technology, is going to make it, I think, easy for people to put themselves in a position to gain irrefutable, unequivocal scientific data of these objects.
Finding out what they are, finding out, if we can, whether their origin is terrestrial or off-world, those, of course, are still open questions. Finding out who's driving them, that's an open question. But I'll tell you something. The question as to whether they exist or not is the dumbest question on the planet. The stupidest question that anybody can ask is, do you believe in UFOs? That debate's over. They do exist. Now, the questions are, what are they? Where do they come from? Who's driving them? Are they being driven, or are they remotely controlled? All of those are fair questions, but the question as to whether they exist or not,
that's been a moot point for a long time, although
only a moron or major
people
media
who aren't
would
into
ask
this
that.
Field would still ask that question, but anybody that's even just scratched the surface or licked the tip of the iceberg of this subject, I mean, it's a slam dunk answer that not only do they exist, but they're flying around and being reported hourly around this planet.
And not only this planet. There are some phenomenal films, videos, of UFOs launching off of the moon. I don't know if you've seen that. You can definitely see UFOs, some kind of craft, launching off of the surface of the moon and heading off into space. Who is that? Well, if NASA's to be believed, it certainly is not us. Not only, have we not been there in almost 50 years, we're not going back. So somebody's launching off of the moon. There are all kinds of NASA videos showing UFOs out there around the space station.
And around the shuttle. I just did a series of talks in California back in January, and at my Orange County talk was a shuttle commander of two shuttle flights, and he seemed very interested in what I had to say. Stuck around the whole 2 hours, which it was a little surprising to me, but not really. And he did take me aside at the end, And I asked him. I said, "Well, why are you here? I mean, you're a NASA shuttle pilot and commander." And he related how a family member had had an incredible sighting in Colorado back in the late 70s, and how he's been fascinated with the subject ever since. Of course, I'm sure he kept his interest rather low key around NASA, but this was enough for him to become a seeker for more information about the subject, and he does occasionally come out to listen to speakers in this field. And so, of course, I couldn't resist the urge to ask him, "Well, have you ever seen something?" And he you know, up there while you're, you know, doing your orbits there in the shuttle. And he says, oh, yeah, we see stuff up there all the time, but we're so busy that if it's not an immediate threat, we don't really pay much attention. Mm-hmm. Which I found was a rather slippery way of saying yes. But then he added the little caveat that he had heard stories, which I unfortunately didn't have the time to press him on that, but I'd like to.
Oh, yeah, I'd like to hear those stories, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, speaking of hearing stories, let's go ahead and dive into the San Luis Valley and weird stuff there. And, you know, you wrote a book about, Stalking the Tricksters, about shapeshifters, skinwalkers, dark adepts in 2012. And it's my understanding that a lot of this information is happening or was happening in San Luis Valley. Is that correct?
Yes, some more than others. Again, the tagline, under the title was trying to encompass the whole subject matter. The San Luis Valley does have its share of what could be called tricksterish type phenomena. The book is rather large, you know, big picture. It does look at the whole archetype of the trickster as it relates to subcultural groups of people all over the planet. So it isn't just limited to the San Luis Valley. It does look globally at the trickster mechanism, as it were. But the San Luis Valley is one of those rare, unique places where there's a variety and intensity of unusual, unexplained phenomena that's kind of unrivaled, really. There's only a few places that come to mind that could rival the amount of activity and the variety of activity that occurs there. There are brujos and brujas. There are, stories of skinwalkers and magical attacks and that type of activity. It's something that's kind of whispered about in the community. You don't really see it, on your local news or in the regional newspapers. It's something that you have to really sort of dig to find.
Okay, we have to step away for break. When we come back, I want to talk about skinwalkers. I want to talk about shapeshifters and find out what you know about these, some people would say mythical beings. I'm not so sure they're mythical. I think there's every possibility that might be real. But we'll find out from Christopher O'Brien when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. This is Kevin Smith, and we're continuing our conversation this evening with Christopher O'Brien. Christopher, as I said before we went to break, I want to jump into this shapeshifter skinwalker thing. Let's start with skinwalkers. Why are you writing about skinwalkers? Have you had some investigation that of skinwalker stories?
Well, not directly. I kind of have to digress here a little bit. Writing three books about, very intense investigative process that I underwent from the end of 92 through 1999, we had a good 7-8 years of really intense, almost nightly activity in the San Luis Valley, which is the largest alpine valley in the world. It extends from south central Colorado down to Taos in north central New Mexico. It's completely ringed by mountains, very remote area. They didn't get broadcast television there, for instance, until the early 80s. It's a real magical area. It's a very sacred location. It's the only spot in America where three regional groups of Native Americans overlapped. The legends and myths and traditions that I have found through research over the years is quite mesmerizing. And writing three books about you know, my chasing around after, you know, 1,200-1,300 UFO reports, over 200 cattle mutilations, haunted sites, strange occult crime, working with law enforcement on trying to track down where some very unusual military activity seemed to be headed and coming from. And I mean, it's just a whole a kaleidoscope, really, of unexplained events. And at the end of writing three books about all this, of course, one of the things that my readers would constantly badger me about is, well, what do you think's going on? You know, you're presenting all this incredible activity, but you're not really coming up with some sort of explanation. So I spent a number of years really mulling over my data, looking for patterns, looking at how aberrant social behavior, strange weather, just, you know, weird fires, roadkill on the roads, and how all this stuff seems to ebb and flow along with waves of UFO sightings. And I was looking for some sort of connecting point or a correlation that would tie all this very interesting these very interesting events together. And the one thing that came through pretty clear is there's something absurd or tricksterish about a lot of this activity, if not all of it. And so I kind of got myself back up to speed with my Carl Jung, of course, who was the protege of Sigmund Freud. Jung was the one that came up with the idea of the collective unconscious, and he related how all of us have these deep archetypal symbols within our psyches and in our subconscious. So, you know, the shadow, the mother, the child, the trickster, the wise man, the king, the queen, the god, the goddess. These are deeply rooted archetypal symbols that we all share cross-culturally around the world. And one of the things that really surprised me is that the trickster phenomenon, or the trickster archetype, if you will, is probably the oldest and most primordial of these archetypes that has facial features. The shadow, the mother, the child, these are probably the most basic and oldest of the archetypes, and they're featureless. And then you have the trickster. And the trickster, by literal definition, is neither young, old. It's not, you know, white or black. It's not positive. It's not negative. It's not self-aware. It doesn't appear to have an agenda. This is the sort of old school, academic, sort of anthropological view of the trickster. And what I've done with this book is I've refuted that, and I've looked at what could possibly tie all these various trickster forms that are found worldwide. There's hundreds and hundreds of different types of tricksters, depending on the continent that you're on. And the one thing that comes through loud and clear is they all have the ability to shapeshift, to turn from one form into another form. And so that was my linchpin right there. That was my correlation that tied these things together. And once I realized that, I was off to the races, and I looked at any sort of paranormal phenomenon that had that aspect of shape-shifting involved in it, and that's where I really got some traction in my own research, and then, you know, was able to really re-examine the trickster with a new, fresh pair of glasses on. And skinwalkers is one Southwest American kind of an example of a human trickster-type form that has the ability to shapeshift. And as you mentioned before the break, yes, these are mythical beings or adepts, if you will, black magicians. And, you know, I've always wondered, well, perhaps there were skinwalkers with high, you know, super exalted talent at one point. Maybe there's a few around now, but it's probably a dying school of belief, or it's actually a medicine society within the Native American cultures here in the Southwest, the Pueblo Indians. And I happened to be called out on a very strange occult case back in the late 90s, in 98, and a very strange skeleton adorned with all sorts of very witchy looking objects was left behind the house of a very prominent resident in Crestone, where I lived. And I was asked to come in attempt to try to explain, you know, what this could be or what it could be used for. And unfortunately, they had destroyed the item, so I wasn't able to get a real good I know a little bit about ritual magic and Native American sorcery. And unfortunately, they did destroy it before I got a chance to become involved. But soon after, within a couple of months, I lived in a house out in the San Luis Valley that didn't have any trees around it. It was separated, you know, by large elk meadows from my neighbors, which were, you know, over a quarter mile, half mile away. And I come home one night, dog tired from working, doing adobe plastering work. I was a, you know, professional adobe plasterer for a number of years. And my shower was in my greenhouse. And as the sun was setting in the west, you know, I had all of my big plate glass windows that were facing the west. And I had a pretty pretty lame little solar system at that point. It was less than 1,000 watts, so I had a little 25-watt bulb. And as I was all soaked up in the shower, the only way I can describe it is a human hybrid deer. It was a upright bipedal humanoid form with a snout and an impressive rack of antlers slid across the entire front of my greenhouse just 10 feet away from me and silhouetted by the setting sun. And boy, I tell you, it's the only time I've ever jumped out of the shower fully soaped up. That was quite a an eye-opening experience, I must say. And at the time, I did not know that much about skinwalkers. I knew some, but I didn't. I hadn't really gone into the in-depth research that I've since, you know, undergone. And come to find out that this is a common description of a skinwalker who is lurking about a person of interest. And skinwalkers, basically, just for those of in the audience that don't know what they are, they're generally referred to as witches or dark adepts within the Diné Indian tradition. Of course, the Diné are the Apache and Navajo, who are the latest arrivals, Native American arrivals to the Southwest. They arrived here about 100 years before the Spanish. Most people don't know that. And there is a medicine society that are really, you know, nasty witches. Basically, you can hire them as mercenaries to you know, to off people, to put hexes on people. There is a very deeply rooted superstitious quality to the Diné people, and I think there are skinwalkers out there that aren't really, by literal definition, skinwalkers. They just palm themselves off to be that, to you know, get people to pay them money to put hexes on people. And at the time when this event occurred to me in the late 90s, I had known a little bit about this particular school of knowledge.
All right. Let me warn you that we have a break coming up here in just a moment. Let me ask you this. You said that there are people that are not actually skinwalkers but kind of palm themselves off as that. But are there actual skinwalkers?
I do think there are, yes. I've had enough, you know, I've had reports and talked with law enforcement, and I've made quite a bit of headway in making inroads in the local Pueblo communities, the Zuni, the Hopi, and other Pueblo tribes. And yes, there are. As a matter of fact, there's a trial that they're trying to figure out how to prosecute a skinwalker who was actually captured. And
okay, I want to hear about that when we come back. A skinwalker was actually captured, and there's an upcoming trial. I want to hear the details of that. Well, it's an amazing thing, is it not, ladies and gentlemen? We live in a world that's quite different from what we have been told. Weird stuff is happening all around us. We'll be back right after this. and welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're delighted to have you. And I think you're going to be delighted to be here as well. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from that first hour. My guest this evening is Christopher O'Brien, and at the moment we are talking about skinwalkers. And as we went to break, Christopher, you said there's a trial going on right now, that, or there's one coming up, that they're not really sure how to handle it. It involves a skinwalker. Tell us about that.
It's actually, the trial is of what is being called a witch, but there's been some rumblings that this may actually be a skinwalker who inadvertently was captured. What makes this particular legal action, I think, especially intriguing, is that it's cross-cultural in terms of one Pueblo has captured a witch and is going to put that witch on trial for doing. And that witch is from another Pueblo. This is the first time that we've seen black magic being perpetrated from one Pueblo to the other, and that perpetrator being captured. And then they're trying to figure out jurisdiction, how to go to trial with this. Of course, you know, Native American tribes are their own sovereign nation, so they have their own legal system. They have their own way of doing things. And generally, these types of individuals, who again are part of a medicine society, if you will, these Pueblos are divided up into clans, Kachina societies, and medicine societies. And these particular witch societies, if you will, are dealt with pretty much exclusively within that particular Pueblo or tribe. And this is the first time that you've seen a witch being hired from another tribe to do, you know, to do something bad in another Pueblo, and then getting busted for it. So they're scratching their head trying to figure out how to actually proceed. I'm not really allowed to identify which Pueblos we're talking about, or the actual events that you know, that went down to you know, necessitate capturing and then taking them to trial. But it is a very interesting development. This is the first time, to my knowledge and to my sources' knowledge, that this type of crime has been perpetrated cross, you know, from one Pueblo to another, and then the person got busted. This type of superstition, this type of hidden adept knowledge, is something that is really difficult to research. This is one of the most taboo subjects within the Native American communities. I've made some innocent requests of people that I've met on the reservation, and they've shunned me ever since. They won't even, if I come in anywhere near them, they'll turn around and go the other way. Just asking about skinwalkers or asking about witchcraft often indicates to the person you're asking it to that you're one of them, and you're a witch, or that you're a skinwalker, and so they will have nothing to do with you. Death and the Dene is a very interesting subject. I mean, we could go into quite a bit of depth about some of the belief systems surrounding the death process within the Apache.
Do you know who Chief Dan is?
Yeah, Kachamba, sure. Yeah, the Hopi elder, Dan Kachamba, who died back in the 70s?
No, Chief Leonard Dan.
Okay. No, where is he from? The name actually rings a bell.
Yeah, he's in New Mexico, and he is Navajo. I believe that's correct. He's been on this show, and he told us, when we talked about skinwalkers, he said that there are some that are very real, and he said that the number is growing among the Navajo, and he said it's a huge problem. He said the number of them is growing, and he said that they have actually been recruited by the U.S. government to work in anti-terrorism.
Well, that's interesting. You know, again, I think that there is an ancient lineage and an ancient school of knowledge that that we're actually seeing. We're seeing that slowly dwindling and slowly dying out. The real super adepts that can shapeshift, turn themselves into various animal forms, lock eyes with you, and be able to jump inside you, astral project inside a person, take over their motor functions. A person is totally conscious but unable to speak or move, and the skinwalker is able to make them go places and do things totally, you know, involuntarily. And change into energy, balls of energy, for instance. I think that ability is dwindling. It's the people that are saying that they have that ability and are palming themselves off as being these ancient adept, people with the ancient knowledge. I wouldn't be surprised if that number is growing. But based on my research, and of course, you know, I'm just a nosy white boy in a black cowboy hat, so what do I know? But based on my knowledge, the real true adepts, I think, I think we're seeing them die out, because this is very, very
well,
this is really interesting area to talk about, and this is a form of sort of negative sacred knowledge, if you will.
You said death in the Dene is that they handle it in quite interesting way. Let's talk about that. When we say Dene, generally, not entirely, but generally, people think of the Navajo, but it also encompasses the Apache, I believe, as you said.
Yes.
And over in Arizona at Window Rock, they have a college, Dene College. That Navajo reservation is a sovereign nation, and it stretches, part of it is in New Mexico, part of it is in Colorado, part of it in Arizona. Am I missing any?
There may be just a little strip of sliver of it in Utah as well.
Okay.
If you put the entire thing in Arizona, it would be about a quarter of the size of the state of Arizona, bigger than many states back east.
Mm-hmm. And it's a little known fact to many Americans, and probably to most who are not part of the United States, they live somewhere else, but little known fact, these are sovereign nations, and they do have their own government. They have a president. You know, they have their own police force, and they have their own courts. It is a sovereign nation. So let's talk about death in the Dene. What's so different?
Well, the Dene are very, very superstitious when it comes to death. For instance, if somebody dies in a traditional hogan, or which is kind of loosely modeled after the Mongolian yurt, which is a round building, temporary structure built out of felt. It's the hogan kind of stems from that. I've joked for years that the Dene peoples were probably chased out of Mongolia and in Asia by Genghis Khan and the Mongol horde back in the 12 and 1300s, and they did the long trek back over the land bridge, the Apaches splitting off and coming down the Ohio River Valley and then circling around through Texas and New Mexico into Arizona, the Dene coming more straight down the West Coast into the Southwest. Most people, as I said before, don't know that they arrived just shortly before the Spanish. So in the 14 and 1500s is when you had a major influx of Dene peoples into the Southwest. And one of the things that that I found very peculiar is their real just avoidance of death. And for instance, if somebody dies in a hogan, they'll pile all their belongings up in there and then do a blessing ceremony, and then no one will ever go in there again. They have a real avoidance of cremation. Two of the tools that are used by skinwalkers allegedly are corpse powder and these strange bone projectiles that are that are used for magical and very negative purposes. And because of the superstitious nature, I think, of the culture, just by and large, anything having to do with death or anything having to do with sorcery as it relates to death is extremely taboo, and it's a subject that they will not discuss. And it's very, very difficult to try to research this type of information. I've combed through anthropological journals, very obscure, little-known books that have been written by academics, and a few actually written by Native Americans that peripherally address these subjects. And the one thing that I can you know, that comes through pretty loud and clear is the Dene people really do have some major hang-ups and issues around death, and for better or for worse, you know, who's to say that that's not appropriate? Culturally, it is for them. And one of the things that I find very intriguing is talking with law enforcement over the years and having contacts on reservations. Some of the stories that you hear about witchcraft and about skinwalkers and about the whole idea of shape-shifting, that really lies at the heart of the skinwalker tradition, hence the name skinwalker. They're able to, you know, put the skin of an animal, generally a deer, coyote is often cited. They clothe themselves with the skin of these animals, and they're able to actually shape-shift into that animal. Generally, they're oversized. Their eyes don't glow at night, whereas when they're in their human form, their eyes do glow at night. There's some very interesting descriptions that seem to be cross-culturally consistent when you're looking at the belief system around these entities. If I hadn't seen that strange deer man glide across my window, I think I'd have a much more kind of objective, sort of, you know, healthily skeptical view of these things. But since I had that experience, and also another experience within a matter of days of that sighting I had while in the shower, I had what I later found out was a common description of a skinwalker encounter, and that is someone going and banging really loud on your house, but going all the way around your house in just a few seconds. Boom, 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 all the way around your house. And then having little rocks and pebbles thrown at your windows and on your roof. That's another description of a skinwalker having interest in you. Once I had those things happen to me, and, you know, having a house that was totally, you know, had no place to hide, nowhere to run. I mean, I had no trees, just grass around me for you know, half a mile to my nearest neighbor, quarter to half a mile. There's no way that somebody could have snuck up and done those things with my million, you know, candle power spotlight that I, you know, of course, instantly whipped out and checked the whole area out. So if I hadn't had those experiences, I think I'd be a lot more skeptical about this than I am now. And now, having done a good solid year's research into these subjects, you know, for the book, Stalking the Tricksters, I have a newfound respect for indigenous ancient wisdom and knowledge surrounding these subjects. So,
all right, tell you what I'd like to do. I'd like to invite the audience to jump in here and join us in this conversation. And it's real easy to do, folks. All you have to do is pick up your transporter device. Some people call it an iPhone or smartphone. And enter these coordinates. 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. If you enter those coordinates into that transporter device, commonly called a telephone, it will transport you here to the studio. And if you have a question or a comment about skinwalkers or anything else we've talked about, please feel free to give us a call and join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you and know what you think. If you're in the USA or Canada, please use the telephone number that I gave you. If you're outside of the USA or Canada, you may use that telephone number. It will work. But we understand that it can be pretty expensive to make international long-distance calls. So if you don't want to call that number, you live outside of the USA, outside of Canada, you can go to my website and use the Flash message option that you'll find on my website, kevinsmithshow.com. Just scroll down. When you see the picture about tonight's show, right above that picture is a link that says Flash Message. Okay? All right, now, you saw this. Describe for us as best you can this skinwalker that you saw as you were taking a shower in your greenhouse.
The way you said that, Kevin, really sounds...
Well, I know the story about why
I'm embarrassed.
Well, tell the story why you were taking a shower in the greenhouse.
Well, I had these large 72-inch, sliding glass door, actually replacement glass. I had five of them lined up for the western side of my greenhouse, and that's where I had my little shower set up because my bathroom hadn't been completed upstairs. Lived in a two-story house and had about 1,000-watt solar setup. So I was in there taking a shower. The sun had gone down. There was a vivid glow on the western horizon. And I noticed movement out of the corner of my eye, and the 25-watt bulb was able to illuminate something that didn't walk, it didn't run, it didn't pace. It was like on a dolly. It slid. It glided across my windows. And as it was gliding, it kind of turned its head and slightly and kind of looked inside at me. And it had, the features of a cross between a deer and a human. That's the only way I can describe it. It had an impressive set of antlers. It had upright on two legs. It had kind of an elongated snout like a deer, but not as long. That's the only way I can describe it.
So its upper torso looked like a human. Is that it?
Its head seemed strange. It had more of a snout. Again, this was silhouetted by the glow in the sky from the sun having set, and I did have a slight bit of kind of light on its front from the light bulb, but it happened so quickly. And I hadn't been out, having beers with the boys after work or anything. I'd been working all day. I was home. I was tired. I was, dirty. I just wanted to get a shower and relax. I was in the middle of a pretty heavy-duty work project. And it freaked me out.
Was it a four-legged animal or
it was upright. It was It was on two legs. It seemed to have sort of human arms. It didn't appear to be like somebody dressed up with antlers on, because it had like a deer head, but it was on a human body. That's the only way I can describe it. And, instantly I got out of the shower and threw some clothes on, and the first thing I did was grab my, million candle power battery-operated spotlight, and I painted the whole, the whole outside of the house, which, again, had no bushes, had no trees. It was a totally open elk meadow that I was in. I had beautiful views of the entire Sangres. I mean, it's a very beautiful area where I lived, and there's no cover. There's no place for anything to hide. So, I still to this day I don't know what to make of that experience. At the time, I didn't have the depth of knowledge about the skinwalker form or phenomenon and the whole medicine society that sprung up around these adepts.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you need the government to tell you it happened?
Oh, absolutely not. No.
There you go.
That was one of the weirdest doorknobs I've ever seen, Kevin.
That's what I'm screaming. All right, let's go to the telephone and caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, Christopher, this is Steve from Georgia.
Hello, Steve.
And Christopher, surely you must know that this image that you saw, or this skinwalker that you saw, is a fairly common subject of cave drawings in Europe. Some of the early cave drawings, like from Lascaux in France, shows upright deer people, shamans or whoever they are hybrid deer people with antlers and pronounced genitalia. You know, I don't know if what you saw had that part, but those are shown in some of the ancient cave drawings from the early days of humanity in Europe. And I think that's interesting that you saw it in the southwest of the United States as well. And not just in a drawing on a cave, but alive and moving.
Yeah, like less than 10 feet away from me. You know, albeit it was on the other side of glass, but still, I mean, there was no mistaking it. And I do have a reproduction of a famous drawing from, I'm not sure if it's from Lascaux, it may be from Altamira, I'm not sure. But I do have a reproduction of one of those forms that you've described from paleo times. This.
Folks, can you hear that? Okay. That is so strange, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know what. Let me turn his volume back up. This is Christopher O'Brien.
This.
Well, that has happened before, but it's pretty strange. We'll give him a call on the telephone and see if we can continue that way. And the telephone is ringing.
Yeah, I'm logging back on.
Okay. Christopher.
Sorry about that. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, well, you know, we had that happen the other day when we were getting ready.
Right,
to,
yeah, it's pretty strange.
Yeah.
You should be able to call me now.
Okay, we'll give that a shot and see. And, well,
interesting. The points in the conversation where these things happen.
Yeah, it is interesting. Steve, we are sorry about that. We had to disconnect from you in order to make contact with Christopher O'Brien because his Skype was jammed up. Anyway, Christopher, it is calling you, and if...
yeah, I'm not getting it.
You're not getting it. Okay.
Oh, there it is. Okay, there we go.
All right.
Can you hear me now?
Well, we shall see. Okay, and the answer to that, Christopher, is no. It's still doing the same thing. So we'll continue here on the telephone. Okay. Are you with me on the telephone, or did you hang up?
I am.
Okay. Yeah, it's still doing the same thing, Christopher.
That's so bizarre, Kevin. I've never had that happen before on a Skype call. And of course, you know, the Bearcats, we use it every week. So
yeah. Well, I don't have no idea what to tell you, but let's see.
Sample and hold.
There it is. Okay, we're going to step away for a break, and we'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, right after this. So don't go away.
And you are smart because you are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Kevin Smith Show. The strange, strange anomaly that we experienced there with... our guest's audio coming in, that was a Skype call. Skype just does weird stuff sometimes, but anyway, we got past that. And the way we got past it is we put him on the telephone line, the incoming line. So that means if you were planning on calling, you waited too late. Sorry about that. We got Chris O'Brien over there now. So Christopher, You said you've never had that happen before, and you use Skype all the time. I can also say we use Skype all the time, and I've never had that happen before.
Well, we're two for two. It happened at the conference too, I think, if I remember.
Yeah. Well, in fact, you had to switch and use a different Skype account to get
exactly.
away from it.
Exactly. You can try calling me again if you want to try it one more time.
All right.
I closed all my other applications. I wasn't doing anything with anything else on my computer at that time, but. If you want, you can try it again.
All right, we'll see what happens here.
This.
Yeah, it's still going, man.
Sample and hold.
Your Skype is locked in.
Yeah. It.
Well, maybe a skinwalker didn't like us talking about skinwalkers.
Maybe.
Who knows? All right, so. Let's get back to skinwalkers for just a moment, and shapeshifters, because a skinwalker is a real one, is a shapeshifter.
Yeah,
right?
By literal definition, yeah.
On this show, a couple of years ago, after having searched for about a year to find a werewolf to interview. I finally found two werewolves that were willing to be interviewed. The ones that jumped up during that year and were all eager to be interviewed, there were things about them that made me suspect that they were wannabes and perhaps were not real werewolves. So we finally I settled on one male and one female. And I interviewed each one separately, and then I interviewed them together. So did a total of three shows. Now, during the interview of the male, where I interviewed him by himself, he was a young guy. One of the really top scientists in this country called in, and he does stuff. He doesn't work for the government, but he does stuff for the government on contract and so forth. And he called in, and he issued a invitation for anybody who says that they are a werewolf, if they're a real werewolf, that the U.S. government, DARPA, he said, would be interested in talking with them about helping this country in fighting terrorism. And he said that on this show.
Wow.
So, to make a long story short, he did had some background checks done. Not just background, but they really checked into the story of each of these werewolves. And he let me know, he sent me an email two or three days later telling me that the kid from, I think it was Alabama, and he's talking about the male, he said, he's the real deal. And that's one of the top scientists in this country. If I were to say his name, a lot of people would know. He has invented and patented several major things used by NASA and used by the U.S. Air Force. And, he said this kid was the real thing. I know there are folks who say, oh, that just can't be. Well, okay. But remember, there was a time when people were saying, you know what, the world is not really flat, it's round. And there were lots of folks saying, that just can't be. Reality is far stranger.
I think you bring up a really good point that as we, progress into this, hyper-technical age that we're in, these sorts of subjects have been relegated to, myth and folklore and superstitious belief. But I have always had a sense that there is something at the core of these types of stories and descriptions of weird talents, if you will. And I don't think that knowledge is as prevalent maybe as it once was, or these abilities are not as commonplace as perhaps they once were, but I do get a sense that there are people with very, very interesting talents out there, let's put it that way.
What's the name of the movie, X-Men? You know, that might not be as far from reality. I know it's fictionalized, but it might not be as far from reality as we think it is. And, you know, there may be some people that really do have some of these really phenomenal abilities. Shape-shifting, of course, would be really phenomenal. And, I mean, you stop and think about it. If you shape-shift, you're actually changing bone structure. And, you know, that's you would think, would have to be pretty painful. Then there is this question. Is the shapeshifter actually shapeshifting or controlling your perception?
Yeah, good point.
And I wonder, you know, if you had a camera set up that had caught this same event, where you were taking the shower and you looked out, you see this skinwalker go past the windows. I wonder if the camera would have seen the same thing you see.
Well, that's a very, very good point and good question. Many of your listeners are probably aware of the interesting book written by George Knapp and Colm Kelleher called Hunt for the Skinwalker, which pretty much gave the story of the Sherman Ranch up in Utah that I became involved in the case very, very early on, before Robert Bigelow and the National Institute of Discovery Sciences bought the ranch and placed, you know, world-class scientists and technology on the ranch to try to capture and you know, validate with sensing equipment the types of phenomenal events that were reported by Terry Sherman, the rancher, and his family. And it's interesting that you should mention the camera. What would it pick up? They had one case where something evidently tore the wires out of one of the surveillance cameras while another camera was actually focused in the direction of the camera that was impacted. And when they rewound the footage from the second camera to find out what happened to the first camera, there was no indication at all of how the wires had been torn out of the one camera, even though it was under, you know, real-time surveillance by a second camera. So, you know, you bring up a good point. Oftentimes, you know, this is why I wrote a book about the trickster, you know, mechanism, if you will, because this is a classic tricksterish scenario where you have real physical effects that are occurring, but there's no indication of how that particular event was perpetrated. In this case, with the camera being rendered useless by pulling all the wires out, they had a perfectly, you know, viable camera image of the camera at the time period when all this happened to it, and there's no indication of how the wires had been pulled out.
Does it show the wires? Does it show the wires suddenly dangling where they had not been dangling, and then suddenly they were?
No, the cameras weren't close enough to really determine that kind of detail. But if anything had climbed up or anything had been in the vicinity that could have done that, the camera would have picked it up. I don't think it was close enough to really pick out that, you know, fine of resolution or detail.
Now, this was on the Skinwalker Ranch, right?
Yeah, the Terry Sherman Ranch up in Utah. I was asked to help the family out back in 1996 before the first major article really hit the wire services, and I did make a trip up there and speak with Terry and saw some of the physical evidence that he had to show, and then he asked me, you know, if I could help him come up with somebody that could buy the ranch so he could get his family out of there, because he was in a place of fear. And before had a chance to call Robert Bigelow or Lawrence Rockefeller, the two numbers I gave him. Bigelow found out about the case and called him and made him an offer he couldn't refuse. NIDS took over the ranch, and you know, there's still guards and security people at the ranch. I actually went up in October helping out the Death of Ventura conspiracy theory crew do a segment up there, and the ranch is still there. It's pretty innocuous looking. I mean, you go up there, you wouldn't think that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of bizarre reports had come from that particular spot, but it looks pretty innocent, you know, just on the surface. But we did have an interesting, unusual kind of UFO sort of light sighting that got filmed. And keep your eyes open on your TV schedules. They should be airing that episode here in the next month or so.
So what's your opinion of the Skinwalker Ranch? Is it infested with skinwalkers, or something else going on there?
Well, again, I think the skinwalker term is almost overused at this point. I think it's kind of a catch-all term to try to come up with a way to create a basket that we can throw a lot of very divergent type of phenomenal events into that basket. The Mountain Utes up there do have a tradition of that being a taboo location. It does seem to be like a portal area where large apertures of light open up in the sky. UFO craft float through and then shoot off smaller craft. There is a tradition locally there that the youths aren't allowed to go there. That's why they sold it to the white boys, because they're not allowed to go there, so why not somebody make some money off the property there? Beautiful little ranch. I don't really know the extent of the activity that's been reported up there. I do have some inside contacts that have been feeding me some interesting information. Back December 2010, there was a very interesting dogman sighting, a wolfman type sighting, where a creature was seen jumping from house to house on some of the reservation housing there further north of the ranch, a couple miles up in the town. And a number of witnesses witnessed a humanoid form with a dog-like head that was able to leap 25, 30 feet from roof to roof, from the cookie-cutter res housing up there. Supposedly a cell phone photograph was taken by one Indian kid. I have yet to see that, and I've yet to come up with that footage, where I'd really like to. But it seems like the activity is regional there. It's not just located at that particular location. It does occur elsewhere, but it does seem to be centered right there in that valley.
So Robert Bigelow funded the investigation, scientific investigation. We have to step away for a break. When we come back, I'd like to hear from Christopher O'Brien. What did Bigelow find out? We'll be back. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're on Final Approach. We only have a few minutes left. But as we went away for break, I asked our guest, Christopher O'Brien, what did the Bigelow-funded scientist find up there?
Well, that's the $64 million question. He took the ranch over in August of 96, and the book Hunt for the Skinwalkers came out in 2005. The book had no photographs. I think there were four people that actually went on record using their own names. There were no maps, no diagrams, no data. Some of the basic facts of a couple of the more interesting cases and events. The dates were wrong based on my at times daily contact with the rancher before Bigelow got involved. So, you know, I'm really not sure how in-depth George and Combs' book really went. I think it was almost a public relations ploy to get some of the attention off the ranch, and I think it backfired. It created a real mecca for people that are into location-specific events, and the ranch has been inundated with onlookers, people trying to break in, and even one guy's even tied a chain to the front gates of the property and tore the gates off. So, I'm not really sure what they've been able to determine. The fact that NIDS kind of quietly folded and went by the wayside could be an indication that they threw the towel in. I think whatever was up there that they were studying, and is probably still there, just played with them to the point where they just gave up. I've heard stories, under the radar about some of the events that occurred there, and it just, whatever it is that's up there, is just playing with these guys. And, as a hard-boiled scientific team, you can only take so much tricksterism before you just throw your hands up and go on to more predictable pursuits. I think that they were just flummoxed. I think that they were totally stymied. They don't have, they have data, of course, but what that data is doing nothing more than confusing them more than probably when they went in.
Well, one of the things that I say frequently here on the show is that the universe did not attend Harvard or MIT or Cornell. It didn't get its PhD where the PhDs got theirs. And it does things. It does things that are outside of the pretty narrow view of established science, and does things that don't fit any of their theories. And I think there are probably life forms that fit that category. There are life forms, I think, that just don't fit with anything we think of when we think of life. And they can pretty much do what they want to do, how they want to do it, and we don't understand. I think it's probably about like the dolphins trying to understand us. They see us, they know we're there, and they wonder, why are they doing?
Yeah, and I'm not sure that any of this is extraterrestrial in nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the further along in my research process and my study of case histories of particular, very, I think, interesting cases over the years, I'm coming more and more to the conclusion that we're dealing with something that's closed. It's a closed system phenomenon generated here on Earth, that whatever these forces are and intelligences are, they're probably more terrestrial than we are. And I think that there's a, obviously we only perceive a thin sliver of the energetic spectrum, and we're not fully aware of what, could potentially be going on around us, just within, the energetic realm that we understand. When you bring quantum physics into it and multidimensional potential for multiple dimensions, then, it could become very, very complex. And I've always contended that we should try to, factor out all the mundane closed system explanations before we jump off planet and think that ET's coming and doing all this absurd tricksterism.
So when you say that it's more terrestrial than we are, I take it that what you mean is it was here before we arrived.
Correct. We may have been introduced into this particular little blue orb floating in space. If you do your research and look at some of the ancient cultures' myths, there's a very interesting body of evidence that you could interpret as kind of saying that we were actually brought here. If you look at the work of Zechariah Sitchin, who, you know, I take with a grain of salt, his interpretation of Sumerian cuneiform in particular terms. But Joseph Farrell wrote a book called Cosmic War, which I really highly recommend to your listeners, Kevin, that looked at cross-cultural stories that seem to be talking about the same event, but just have their own sort of spin on it. And one of the things that he brings up is this constant reoccurring theme that humans could have been introduced here or cross-hybridized with the Homo erectus, and we may have been a created species with the introduction of something from outside the planet and the intervention of something possibly extraterrestrial. Again, you know, the jury's out on all this. I really do think that we're dealing with something that is part of our, as much a part of our environment and in our landscape as we are. And I think that a lot of people have been programmed by the media to believe that this is all alien coming here from elsewhere. And, you know, for the life of me, I can't figure out why anybody would think we're important enough for anything out there. And there's obviously billions of life forms and probably civilizations spread just through this galaxy. But, you know, to think that they're coming here and that we're important enough for them to be bothering with is very primitive, backward, misogynist, you know, patriarchal, you know, place. I just have a hard time believing that. I think that a lot of these phenomenal events are being perpetrated by entities or an intelligence that is as terrestrial as we are.
Well, then, that makes it all the more intriguing, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it certainly fits with what I say. I mean, that doesn't mean that it's right. I mean, I could be wrong. I'm not, but I could be. And that is that there is strange phenomena all around us right here on this planet that's beyond our understanding, and at this point, beyond our ability to understand. I don't think it always will be, but at this point, it is beyond our ability to understand a lot of this. And these strange life forms, whatever it is, strange energies, life forms, beings, whatever it is, are operating just beyond what we can see. And we can only, you know, if we could look at the entire light spectrum, if we could see it, and if we could visualize that it's 1 mile wide, the entire light spectrum, what our eyes can actually perceive is about 4 or 5 inches of that 1 mile. And
yeah,
so
yeah,
there's
and
a lot of stuff
a real
happening.
That's indication
out there.
That we, you know, we just as genetic, you know, biological humans with limited perceptive abilities in terms of visual perception, for instance, you know, we've got blinders on. We're only perceiving a small little slice of the energetic spectrum, and I think that it's important for people to realize that.
I wish we had more time. We don't. We got caught by the bumper music. Stay on the line with me for a moment, Christopher. And ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it. That's a wrap for this evening. Weird stuff and all. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.